to Pop Break TV's Saturday Morning Adventures, where contributors to thepopbreak.com and their friends kick back, tune in, and zone out to the kids' cartoons that define their childhoods and the ones that still give them life to this day. My name is Alex Marcus, podcasting director of thepopbreak.com, and we are here on The Pop Break, our new podcasting feed. We are so excited. If you came here thinking we were Pop Break TV, we have a new name. If you don't care, doesn't matter. It's not going to change anything. You're subscribed to us. It's all good. All of our episodes are still here. You can listen to all of our back episodes, including all of the episodes that I did of this podcast with the lovely Kay Anderson, who is once again here talking with me today about X-Men 97. Hi, Kay.
Hello. How are you?
I'm so good. I'm excited. We're in a new home. We got new logo art. We're just like the X-Men 97 crew, lightly rebranded and ready for action.
Yep. I'm buying that fantasy.
Now, speaking of fantasy, we are here to talk about the Operation Zero Tolerance arc, part one of three, the three-part finale of season one of X-Men 97. I cannot believe we're already talking about finales. It feels like we only just started talking about this show. So much has happened. So excited by everything that we've seen so far. There's been heartbreak. There's been drama. There's been space birds. They've given us a little bit of everything.
Space birds and earth birds as well.
That's true. Birds of all kind. Demon birds. The best kind of birds. So I would like to take just 1 second before you talk about this episode to just reflect on the season as a whole, because we're in the final three episodes now. It's a three-part finale, right? Mm-hmm. So we have the whole rest of the season behind us. How do you feel about this? How did it like live up to your expectations? Do you feel like you're overstuffed? Do you feel like you're ready for this climactic conclusion to this first season of the show?
I think I've probably said all of the things that I think in past episodes, and it's mainly that
Jean is a bitch.
Jean's just inconsistent in her about. I don't think she's a bitch. I just think she's a bit all over the place. And for someone who's a psychic, I think, you know, she should kind of get it together. Like, you could read like a few other people's minds and be like, oh, actually, I'm not regulating my emotions like all these other people, so maybe I could, you know, figure that out. Anyway, that's not what you asked me. I think that my main gripe with the show so far is that they've crammed way too much in and we haven't built up to things. But I think that's probably partly because all TV shows are finished in 10 episodes now, so they kind of did. If it was like in 97, they would have had a 24 episode order count, and then they could have like actually like massaged these stories a bit. I think that's my main gripe. Other than that, I have enjoyed it when I'm not getting whiplash.
Is there a standout character that you have just kind of either you're so excited that they've lived up to your expectation or that you are surprised to have fallen in love with over these first seven episodes?
Ooh, I don't know. I kind of know all these characters a lot. So I'm kind of, they have turned out to be the way I expected. I guess other than Morph, I really like Morph's kind of sly bitchiness. I thought that was really enjoyable. And that's not anything like the comic book character Morph in Exiles. That character was always just quite like lovable and inoffensive. So it's nice that Morph has a bit more teeth in this. Other than that, I really appreciate how little Wolverine has featured. And it's not because I don't like Wolverine as a character. I really do like Wolverine as a character. But lots of times in these ensemble shows, they just show too much of him. And it just gets a bit like, oh, I don't care anymore. So yeah, I like that he's been more of a supporting character in this.
Yeah, I'm going to say that I think that like beta male Wolverine is my favorite development for this show as well. I love that he is just like the shoulder to cry on and supportive second spouse to Jean throughout this. I love him like bringing her to the hospital to help deliver the baby. I love him
helping her. He
didn't
bring Jean to the hospital.
Well, it turned out to be Madeline, but then Jean acquired all of Madeline's memories.
Oh, yeah, as you do. In this episode, yeah.
You know, Is it, in a sense, it is Gene after all. So, but yeah, I just love how he's been used here. And I think that it brings out a really fun dimension to the character, because I feel like he's shown to be so caring and sensitive while also being so like brash and you know, propulsive in the action sequences,
which is totally in keeping with the comic book character. Like it's not a surprise. Like if you read the comics, yeah.
And there's a way in which you could describe the Hugh Jackman Wolverine in that way as well, but he has the burden of being the protagonist of so many of those stories as well. So he has to carry a lot more of the dramatic heft. And I think that kind of, it leaves less fun spaces to show off these other dimensions of the character. And so I'm really happy by that development. And I think we get a little bit more Wolverine here, and we get a little bit more of everybody, because we kind of, in this episode,
apart from Bishop,
basically, we get Bishop spoken of, just completely failing at his job.
Poor Bishop.
Yeah.
Okay,
but
sorry.
So we're basically the show, the narrative at this point is kind of split into a couple different corners. We got the Jubilee and Bobby. And the toxic family relationships. We got Gene and Scott and Cable and the toxic family relationships. And you know, we have the Nightcrawler and Rogue and the toxic family relationship. So we're really centering on a good theme this episode.
Just hang on. Nightcrawler and Rogue come from toxic backgrounds, but they don't have a toxic family dynamic.
Their dynamic isn't toxic, but like you said, they come from they've salvaged something beautiful, although she is unconscious in this term. Yeah. So we kind of have to take
she
Kurt's
didn't
word
confirm
for it.
It. Yeah, so let's wait and see.
Yeah. But so where, like, you know, obviously the story progresses across a linear arc, but I feel like we can kind of hit on any one of these in any order. So where would you like to start?
Let's start with the Summers family clan.
Okay. So they really are a family together in this episode. Was that a surprise for you? I wasn't necessarily expecting them to lean that hard into it. But then once I saw it, I thought, oh, of course they were going to do this.
Yeah. Oh, hang on. So we talked about the first 7 episodes. We didn't talk about 8th episode, because I've been so excited that I get to tell you today that I enjoyed this episode.
You did? Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, we're burying the lead on that one. I think I just was like ready for a mixed reaction, so I didn't even want to ask.
No. So yes, absolutely everything that I've just said, they've crammed too much in the first 7 episodes, blah, 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 blah. But this episode, even though there was so much going on, I didn't feel like, oh, for fuck's sake, now what's happening? I was just like, yeah, this makes sense, because we have like built to this point, I guess.
Yeah.
And everything and felt, it's there were a few plot holes, and I'll bring them up.
It's also part 1 of 3. So I think that the pacing probably helps there as well.
Yeah. I mean, but if this was a standalone episode, it still would have felt like satisfying. We only, like, you know, the fact that the title of the episode is part 1 and then the next one is part 2 and the next one is part 3 is the only reason that we know it's a 3-parter.
I agree with you. They're telling a beginning, middle, and end in a way that I was maybe not exactly expecting, which I prefer. I always, you know, sometimes we run into the Stranger Things problem where it's just like a giant slab of story that just seems to be sliced up haphazardly without any logic or reason behind it. And I was a little bit worried about this being a 3-part episode that we would feel similarly. And I'm glad that that's not the case here, that it really feels like we're getting a closed story with really fun cliffhangers at the end. And that's very promising for next week, where oftentimes the middle episode of a 3-parter can be the hardest one, because you're just kind of stuck in the middle of everything.
All the threads have come unraveled, but none are getting wound. I don't know where I'm going with that. But yes.
Exactly. Perfect. Yes. You're right at that part of wrapping a Christmas present where all of the edges aren't lining up. So you don't have any of the excitement of picking out the paper, and you don't have any of the satisfaction of getting all those lines and edges even. You're just right in the middle of it, ready to pull your hair out.
But you still have all the anxiety that it's going to go wrong. Yeah.
Exactly.
But okay, so that, yeah, I needed to report that. I do have a few things in the plot that I was like, well, that doesn't make any sense. So I will bring that up, and I will probably sound like I hated everything, because that's just what I sound like when I talk about things. But I really enjoyed it. Okay, so Summer family clan and their dynamic. Well, yeah, I don't know what to say.
They rush over the reveal that, like, Cable is Nathan, like, in the end of last week's episode, in a way that was almost anticlimactic. We talked about that last week. But I was very pleasantly surprised to see that they just lean hard into it. It was just like, okay, now we know that that's your son. And Scott has a moment of kind of like, man, I sent you into the future because I thought it was what was best for you. But it turns out I sent you into a post-apocalyptic nightmare. I'm the worst dad ever. So, and I'm glad someone rose that point, because that was a necessary point.
The thing here that makes no sense to me is that Cable told them that Bishop and he got separated in the time stream. And I'm like, you were a baby. How the hell do you remember that? Like, how would you even know that? How would you even know who Bishop was?
He is like the world's most powerful telepath, right? So maybe that's why he was able to know. Maybe that like increases your ability to retain memories as an infant.
Maybe. But I mean, I just found that very odd that, oh, Bishop. Yes, I totally remember him. We were, you know, I was a newborn, but we got lost in the time stream. Anyway, moving on.
Or maybe he's just like 50 years old, so he's had time to figure out what happened, you know, where he didn't initially know that Bishop separated from him in the time stream. He was just like a baby living in the age of apocalypse or whatever.
Well, who told him? Who told him he was from the past?
Well, now he's a time traveler. He's got a supercomputer named Ship, who could have absolutely helped. And he's been traveling through time and space for the last, you know, at least 30 years.
Yeah,
so he
but
could have pieced it together.
I don't know. I need a bit more. I need just a bit more than just like, oh yeah, we got lost. Oopsie. Like, yeah.
I would like to know why Bishop never tried to get him back also. I think that's a good question.
Well, Bishop like was lost. Like Bishop, oh yeah. So okay.
Like is what, like I like that we're leaving that as a cliffhanger. I wonder if Bishop is just lost in the time stream now, and like maybe next season we'll get an episode of him stuck, because it's not the first time he's been stuck in the time stream. There's an episode in the original series where he's kind of like found the nexus of reality by accident after getting tossed into the time stream, and he ends up foiling Apocalypse.
Yeah. I just, you know, get a new storyline, Bishop. I mean, how many times can you get lost in the time stream? Anyway, so you were saying Dean is trying to comfort Scott, who's feeling a bit bereft about his son coming back and being 20 years older than him.
Yeah, and she's kind of saying like, well, you can look at it like you're the world's worst dad, or you can say, look, he's coming back to try to undo all of the bad stuff that happened. And I gotta say, I'm oftentimes the person in the conversation who's like, well, let's look at the other side of that and see if we can find an optimistic perspective. But that was extremely sweaty coming from Gene.
Yeah.
I appreciated the effort, but
and,
yeah,
where, and like,
know.
Where did she suddenly become the voice of reason after being like this hot and cold thing for the last 3 weeks?
She's getting memories of orange slices and cottage cheese. So she's like, you know, a whole new lady.
I can't judge. I've never been pregnant.
No, or never absorbed the memories of your pregnant clone.
Yeah. Oh, no, I mean, I have done that, but I've never been pregnant.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So the interplay between Scott and Cable is pretty fun in this episode, with like Cable being shocked that Cyclops has a Porsche tucked away in the jet. And the look that Scott gives him, like, I do have a Porsche. Like, all right. This is perfect. And they get to blast people together. That's fun. And then the other side of it is the whole Gene thing, where she's kind of like wrestling in this like psychodrama for herself over like, is it my son? Is it not my son? I'm going to tell him to wear his seatbelt. But then like, I also don't, but he also doesn't care about me because I'm not really his mom, like all that stuff. So did both of those stories work for you within the context of what was a story that was, from a plot perspective, really about setting up Bastion and his origins and what his whole deal was? So there's a lot of dense storytelling in this corner of the show this week.
Yeah.
Is it too much?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the only criticism I guess I would have is that they all slotted into those roles very quickly.
Yes.
But like you kind of have to, right? Because you have to get through. And we don't exactly know how much time has passed since the last episode. So maybe they've been hanging out, shooting bottles in the backyard. I'm not sure.
Yeah. For me, it mostly worked. I like dense storytelling. I would prefer that over an episode that feels like it's getting dragged out. So I'm okay with that. Just like overload me with emotional melodramas, please. And I would be so happy. So it worked for me in that respect. And I did like the sort of like mirroring of their kind of situation with Bastion's situation, right? They're like Cable is a cyborg who has been infected by the techno-organic virus and has this like complicated relationship with his parents, and it seems like in many ways Bastion in this version of the character is as well. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of sets them up in a very interesting way that I wasn't necessarily expecting, because it seemed like Cable was sort of there to be the almost like a plot engine more than an actual character who is going to be central in this final arc. But I think that it kind of feels like Cable is Bastion's foil in a lot of ways, and that makes me very intrigued where things are headed.
The one thing I probably didn't really pick up was Jean's emotional state of mind in the way that you've described it. I kind of just thought she was just kind of rolling with the punches a bit more rather than feeling conflicted or feeling like, oh, this is really fucking weird.
We get a brief monologue where she talks more about the fact that she has absorbed all of Madeline's memories, yes, to the point where they feel like her own. So she remembers Nathan kicking inside of her, even though she wasn't ever pregnant with him. She remembers what it felt like to see him and hold him for the first time, to be his mother, even though she's not. And she has that conversation with Nightcrawler, where Nightcrawler says, like, family is a choice. It's not about blood. And so that is kind of, I think that helps color other moments throughout the episode in terms of like the moment where she tells Cable to wear a seatbelt and is sort of like frustrated with him, the part where she kind of calls Scott and Cable out on both being so stubborn, right? Like, and which on the other hand I'm like, and you're not Jean. But so like there are, so I feel like there's this tension between the ways in which she's acting and then what we know because of that speech to Nightcrawler about how she's feeling, right? She's acting more and more like the mother and slotting in, but we know internally there's a lot more complications there.
Yeah, okay, yeah, good point. I guess I just not really connected the dots there.
But anyway, I really liked this. I liked that they kind of snuck in like a pretty comprehensive background on Bastion while we were caring about something else. I thought that was an interesting way to deploy that exposition, because you could have gotten it anywhere.
This is the other thing that confused me. Like, how did Cable not be like, oh, do you know what? This is what's probably going to happen. Why is Cable not predicting everything that's going to happen?
I think we have to just assume that Cable's presence in this episode is changing the course of events to enough of a degree that he can't completely predict what's going to happen. And also, he knows the big broad strokes, but he doesn't know the details. That's usually the deal with time travelers, right? Like, if we went back to the 1700s, we would know, like, oh yeah, like, Thomas Jefferson, he's important, but we're not going to know, like, oh, if these six events who's happen Thomas in Jefferson? This exact order. Well, exactly. So I think that
But if you were like in some stranger's house that you were just like showing up at, and they were like, let me just go to the other room for a minute, like, does that not set alarm bells off for you?
I mean, between the three of them and the experiences that they've had,
they
should know better than anyone that old lady is going to try to kill them.
Okay, good.
I'm with you on that. Did you like some of the Easter eggs that they snuck into Bastion's bedroom? I don't know if you noticed.
Oh, I saw the Stark Industries, or maybe it was Stark something, the box.
Yeah, it was the Stark Expo. Yeah, there was a Stark Expo poster. And then there was a Metal Man, who's like a kind of obscure Marvel character.
Oh, no, I didn't see. There's a Metal Man. Who's Metal Man?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was like one of those like 90s characters where like try to make them happen and they never really happened. Oh, not next character, but yeah.
So it's not like a pre-Iron Man.
No. Separate, unrelated. But
do they have all the medals? Like Gold Man, Silver Man, Copper Man?
Well, there's Silver Mane, That's a Spider-Man villain.
Hmm.
Goldman, I don't know. Isn't there like an X-Man?
Goldman who can, Sachs. Like, yeah.
Sure. Yeah, they fund some of the bad guys. That's like Dr. Doom. He manages his portfolio. But yeah, isn't there an X-Man who like gold balls comes out of his body or something like that?
I think his name's Golden Balls.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, they run out after a while. Come on. But he's one of the... He's very instrumental in Krakoa.
Yes, that's why I have heard of him. Yeah. But okay, so it ends in such a really intense way, I thought. Like the way that Scott and Jean and Cable are fleeing for their lives. Like they have to abandon the Blackbird. I like the part where Jean is like, this is the third Blackbird we've totaled in the last 3 months. It's great moment. And I also like the idea that, oh no, our plane is overrun by flying cyborgs. Here's my solution. Let's all get into my Porsche. Like, I feel like that's not going to help the problem at all. Like, go to space.
But also Jean like was fighting them off with her telekinesis and like flinging them away, and then all of a sudden she couldn't anymore. Like, what was going on?
I think she just got like, well, she was like knocking the ones that were on the windshield away, like she was swatting flies, which I loved. But then they started to land on this top of the plane too, and I think it just got to be too much.
And suddenly
she's
like the world's most powerful. I mean, they're all the world's most powerful. But like, she's the world's most powerful. Like, how could that not? Anyway.
That's why I think the scene is so strong, is because I, at least, got really caught up in how perilous it all felt, that I wasn't thinking that Jean is so much more powerful than these things and could absolutely just wreck them. Even though that's definitely true. But, and while all of this is happening, of course, X-Mansion wouldn't be an event if the X-Mansion didn't blow up. And we get an incredible fight sequence with Wolverine and Nightcrawler trying to guard Rogue's unconscious body. We don't talk a lot about the action sequences, I think, because we get like really caught up in the emotion, old melodrama of it all. But this action scene really stood out to me. How did you feel about it?
Yeah, like Wolverine just like flying through the sky and like hitting anything that gets in his way. Like that was a good scene. I like that.
Yeah. And it immediately made me think like, oh, this is why they're doing this storyline, because it lets Wolverine just absolutely slash through a bunch of people and it's okay because they're all robots.
But is it okay? Like they were people. I mean, I don't care if they're dead. But yeah. Like, what if the family wants to bury them? And they've just
I think in many cases the whole family are robots. So.
Well, yeah, that's true as well.
As it turns out, like Bashit turned his whole town, if Jean is correct, turned his entire hometown into cyborgs. So that's a bold move by Bastion.
Yeah. Well, this is what happens in small towns. There's not much to do. So you're like, yeah, cool. I'll go to the lab, get experimented on.
Yeah, I can fly now.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome. I won't remember being brutally tortured. Okay, fine. I'll sign me up.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I liked some of the moments of the Prime Sentinels being activated were pretty fun. Like there is a scene of a bunch of people protesting outside of either the X-Mansion or the White House. I wasn't positive which it was. In case they're protesting. And then suddenly half the protesters just turn into robots and fly away. And the other protesters are like, wait, what the fuck just happened?
The one thing I want to say is, and this, like, I don't remember Operation Zero Tolerance from the comics that much. The one thing that I was thinking about all of these Sentinels is that they look a lot like Vision's family. So in the comic books, Vision has, like, he's not with Scarlet Witch anymore. Is he with Scarlet Witch in the MCU universe? I don't know. Anyway,
in the MCU universe, they were together. They were going to try to start a life together, and then Thanos ripped the Mind Stone out of his head and he killed Vision. But then, of course, in WandaVision, suddenly Wanda and Vision are together in a family in a sitcom world. And what we eventually find out, spoilers for WandaVision, is that actually that's not the real Vision. That's just like a projection that Wanda has created through her reality warping abilities. But also during that, the body of Vision gets rebooted and is turned into White Vision, and he doesn't really have his memories exactly, and he just kind of fucks off at the end, and we don't really know what happens to him yet, because that was 3 years ago, and we haven't seen him again.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know much about the Avengers. I'm going to sound like I don't know what I'm talking about because I don't know what I'm talking about. But in the comic books, he creates a whole family for himself that's got nothing to do with Scarlet Witch, because fuck Scarlet Witch, right? And
I think it's during the time when Scarlet Witch is with Wonder Man, whose brain was used in the comics as like the basis for Vision's brain. Just very, very Madeline Jean coded development.
Yeah. I mean, not unusual in the Marvel Universe. But, and so these Sentinels kind of remind me of his family. And I know that, like, it's got nothing to do with his family. This is me taking us off on a really strange path that we probably will struggle to get back from. But I just want to say that, just in case Vision is involved in some way in the future, and then it's on record that I've said it. Even though you might edit this bit out.
So many times. You've been right so many times before with your predictions. I don't think you're headed to a correct prediction here, though. I think that the idea is more, especially now that we've learned more about Bastion and his origins, it seems like he has kind of weaponized the techno-organic virus that Cable was infected with. And in order to turn these people into evil cyborgs. I think that's what we're supposed to be kind of coming around to the realization of. So I think it's more of a techno-organic thing that we're seeing with what the Prime Sentinels look like. And, you know, Vision and his family are techno-organic beings, but not because of the techno-organic virus, just because of other reasons. So
it's okay. You can tell me I'm full of shit. That's fine. It'd be much quicker.
No, I love a good theory, and I love anytime you get me to talk about the love affair between the robot and the witch. I'm like so excited too. So, and they are technically X-Men adjacent characters, you know, Scarlet Witch, member of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants,
and she was Magneto's daughter for a while, but now isn't.
Every once in a while, they just switch it up just to keep us. I think currently she's considered an enemy of mutants, but, you know, for a while she was one. So who's to say?
Well, and then she got rid of like 99% of the world's mutant population. But let's not linger on that. Right. What were we up to next?
She was sad. And listen, we've all done things that we regret when we were sad. But yes, so that fight scene, going all the way back to Wolverine and Nightcrawler. Yes. I thought it was awesome. I love the moment where like Trish Tilby Cyborg is like, why do you bother fighting us? It's inevitable. And Wolverine is like, I got six reasons. And he like shows off his claws, and then Nightcrawler with his three blades. truly pirate blades. He's just like, I got make that nine, which is much funnier in a German accent, but I'm not gonna attempt a German accent.
I wish you would.
I don't think you do.
Can we just go back a little bit? So I was really confused when Beast was in the lab with the dead body of Trask. And someone who I think maybe was Morph was just like, oh, yeah, Trish Tilby, you journalist who has a worldwide platform. Why don't you just go into the lab?
Yeah, I think so. They mention at the beginning of that scene that she has come as a friend and has not brought her microphone. And
so what?
Beast.
She's still a journalist.
Beast has a killer line where he says, oh, I didn't recognize you without your camera and microphone. I love Beast being shady. But yeah, you're right. I guess they said it's off the record, so it's okay. Show that they have the corpse of a wanted man.
Yeah,
in your basement.
Yeah, I mean, I think they had it coming, to be honest.
Yeah.
If you're going to let Trish Tilby in, like, what are they expecting? Of course she's going to turn into a sentinel and try to murder them all.
Are you upset to see Trish be treated like this legacy character, Trish Tilby? Longtime Beast love interest.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. So because I hate Beast so much in the comic books, it's hard not to hate Beast in this cartoon, even though he's not the beast that's descended into the evilness and the like weird moral compass of the beast of the comic books. So I kind of want, I don't know. It would be nice for him to have a love interest.
Yeah, I think they're like, their whole thing is, I believe they oftentimes have a sort of like hateable will they won't they to them. They're always like kind of like sniping at each other, and he's always mad at her for doing her job and she's always doing her job. I think that's like a big tension in the many of the arcs. I remember there's like a whole storyline around the legacy virus where she kind of like reports that there might be a chance that it could cross over to humans, and it causes this whole big uproar, and he gets really mad at her about that, and she has to apologize for engaging in salacious journalism. But yeah, I don't think they ever really consummate that relationship. I think they're always just like flirty and sniping at each other. So I guess in that sense, I'm not super upset to see her turn into an evil cyborg and try to kill everybody. Might be the most interesting thing that Trish Tilby's ever done.
Oh, I don't know. You know, so having someone to flirt with is better than having no one to flirt with, right? Like, who's...
I suppose, but once you get the ex out of the way, you can get somebody more interesting in there.
Yeah, okay. Well, who, like, has Beast had any other love interests ever?
There's like that Beauty and the Beast arc from the 80s in the comics where he and I think it's like him and Dazzler, right? Aren't they the center of that arc?
Oh, yeah, don't know. Sorry.
Yeah. So there's been moments. I'm sure that there's like some mousy scientist girl who he pined after at one point in the 60s or something. But it's no Mystique love affair like in the prequel series.
Oh, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, in the movies, in the prequel films, Mystique and Beast have a...
Oh, have do a, they? A,
oh. Yeah, because they bond over both being blue, I guess, you know, as you do.
Yeah.
But then it's like a love triangle between Mystique and Beast and Magneto. And
he's got his hands all over everything.
Beast loses out. Yeah, Beast loses out pretty hard and never really recovers. But
yeah, well, I mean, if you've seen Magneto hung by a giant X in a laboratory, then you wouldn't pick Beast either, would you?
No, hung in many senses. let's talk about that. How do you feel about that development? I mean, we had that cliffhanger at the end of the episode last week of Magneto and being kidnapped, and we're like, where is that going? And suddenly it's, you know, Val Cooper hanging out in the underground lab with doing what exactly? Being the representative of the UN, because it turns out all of this has been sanctioned this whole time, but we didn't know it was going to go this far. No. What do you think about this?
Well, so first of all, choices. Like, why did they not just let him wear clothes? Or, like, just drape something over him, first of all? That's a minor
detail.
Why do
you have to be in an X? Also, like, that just seemed way extra. Like,
symbolism.
All of that was...
Symbolism, come on.
Sure.
The other thing, so this isn't my theory. This is what I've read on the internet, but I can't stop thinking about it. The theory that Val Cooper is actually Mystique. Have you heard this?
Oh, I have not heard that. That's interesting.
I'm not sure if anyone has any evidence on this, like if there's any clues that point towards this being the case. But Val Cooper is like a government official who is like towing the line. You know, she's representing the buttoned up, sensible human type. Why would she let Magneto go?
Well, the episode wants us to believe that she is so scandalized by the what the UN's sort of mutant phobic like inclinations have brought into the world that she needs to make up for that guilt that she feels by liberating Magneto and letting him set things right.
Yeah.
Because as the episode ends, she says Magneto was right.
So good. But yeah,
I can buy that. I can buy it as an arc for her. I think I could also buy Mystique posing as Val Cooper, which she, I believe, did very often during that X Factor era where Mystique was on the team and Val Cooper was supposed to be the one in charge along with Forge. So I could definitely see that happening. Do you think that would add to this story at all? If it turns, because that's always the thing that whenever an internet rumor sparks like that, where it's like, actually the thing you thought you were watching, it wasn't that at all. It was this. Like, my question is always, does that add to the story? Would that enhance the experience in some way? Or is that just like a clever like fan theory?
Well, it's... I don't know. Part of me wants it to just be a fan theory, because it's actually more powerful if a human is the one that says Magneto was right and then lets him go.
Yeah.
And also, I maybe would expect more clues if it was actually Mystique, like something to tell us, like, oh yeah, this isn't what we thought it was. But yeah, I'd still like Mystique to show up. But also, Nightcrawler talked about his relationship with his mum in this very episode, which
could
be
foreshadowing. That is true. So that, yeah, giving us a little bit of context for an eventual reveal. Mm. And there is also the fact that, like, we got no inclination that Madeline was Madeline and not Jean until all of a sudden Jean popped up at the end of that episode. Mm. So there is precedent for a identity reveal out of nowhere. But... yeah, I don't know. I agree with you. I think that it's more powerful if it's actually Val Cooper making that choice. I do think that it's notable that, at least in this continuity, as it is in the comics and not so much in what we're used to, that Magneto and Mystique don't have like a romantic relationship. They don't have a established sort of, you know, partnership in the way that they were presented to have in like the live action films. Mm. They're very much too... sort of like rogue actors running sometimes together and sometimes in opposite direction. So I, in that sense, that both makes me feel like it's less likely that it would be Mystique, because why would she just do that for, unless she had an angle, you know, that would suit herself. Mm, like she's not just his loyal servant in the way that she is presented in the live action stuff. But then also makes me kind of want it to be Mystique, because what is her angle then? And that would be fun to find out what that angle is, you know? But yes. I would lean on the Val Cooper thing. I think ultimately it's more powerful if it's a human.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So throw that away. What else did you make of this set of scenes?
Did you know, I have to say this, because we have talked about Val Cooper several times over the last few weeks, and I have never gotten an opportunity to bring this up. So I just wanted, do you know, are you aware of the origins of Val Cooper?
No, I'm not.
It's a Twin Peaks reference. It's established at the beginning that it's Dale Cooper's FBI agent sister.
And so was Peter David the one who introduced this character?
I believe so, yeah.
Ah, okay. Oh, well, that would make sense if it was him. Oh, he's such a good writer.
Yeah, so like Twin Peaks is technically, canonically part of the Marvel Universe. They never explicitly say Dale Cooper, I believe, but they like allude to my brother, who's an FBI agent, like in the Pacific Northwest or something like that, you know, like really connecting the dots in a fun way. So that's why she's Val Cooper. But yeah, so all of that stuff in the dungeon, we get more of Bastion's plan. We get What did you make of all of this stuff? Are you surprised to learn that the UN was more involved in the attack on Genosha than initially let on?
Well, speaking of the UN, in that scene, there's Doom, there's Baron Zemo. And then there's like a shadowy figure, like outline of a woman's head. Who do you think that is?
Yes. Madam Mask, would that be, is that giving her too much credit to be amongst that company?
I have no idea who it is. But it was just interesting that you got to see Doom and Baron Zemo, but not this person.
Could it be like an Emma Frost, like illusion?
Oh, Emma Frost. Representing Genosha?
Or just like maybe she had like an ulterior motive this whole time. Maybe she was like, you know, like Ooh. Sinister, trying to be part of the alliance against the mutants to play her own angle.
Oh no, not Emma. No, no. Let's go with Madam Mask.
Okay.
But yeah,
recently was the big player in the Marvel Comics gang war.
I didn't read that. So that's like a Spider-Man type.
Well, yeah, Spider-Man and a bunch of like New York street heroes.
Daredevil. Oh, I love Daredevil. Anyway.
She-Hulk.
Oh.
Luke Cage, who's apparently the mayor of Manhattan right now.
Oh, yeah. Took over from Fist.
If you'd like a review of Marvel's Gang Wars, you can check out thepopbreak.com, where we have been covering that in the comics section.
Oh, and Spider-Woman as well. Anyway, sorry, doesn't matter. Right. We're going off. So... I don't know. Okay, so I have to be honest with you. Whenever these there are these scenes with the big bad going like, here's my evil plan and I'm going to spell it out. I kind of just stopped paying
right?
attention.
Yeah.
So there wasn't, there wasn't much response from me when this scene was happening, other than like, Val, why are you just like standing around, like taking this? Like, what are you doing here? That was basically my response.
That's mostly how I felt too. But then once it became clear in retrospect that the main point of all of that was to implicate humanity in the atrocity directly, right? And their arrogance for teaming with a person they didn't fully understand, you know, Joker in the Dark Knight style. And then ultimately giving her a redemption arc to free Magneto. Ultimately, I think it works. But yeah, in the moment, I was kind of like, I don't know. What's the deal with this? I don't know if Bastion is really selling it as a compelling villain. I kind of want more of Sinister, less of Bastion. I kind of don't care about Val Cooper that much. So I was kind of struggling a little bit through some of those scenes. But then it pays off well enough that retroactively I can support it.
Yeah, and I have to say, having three white, cis, able-bodied men in Trask, Gyrick, and Bastion, it just gets confusing.
Well, luckily, two of them are dead now.
Yeah, two of them are dead now, but like, it's just like, wait, so who are you again? What? How does this go? What? So, yeah. That might just be a me thing, but those characters are all very similar.
I just want more Sinister. I know he's up to something. I want to see what that is. And I think I could have used like a tiny bit more of a tease. I don't want them to tell me yet, but a little bit more of a tease than just being like, well, he gives me access to mutant test subjects. Like, okay, like for what? Give me a little bit more, just a tiny nudge. I think my theory now is that he's cloning Magneto. We're going to get a Joseph clone.
Yeah.
Because this episode, I mean, well, I don't want to jump straight to the end, but we were talking about Magneto getting out and kind of, and Magneto does get released and he goes to North Pole and he kind of shuts down all of the electromagnetic power of the Earth to take out all the cyborgs. Mm-hmm. And that reminded me a lot of the Magneto War arc from the late 90s, which ironically is the thing in the 90s that gives Magneto Genosha in the first place. So I think that it's kind of interesting that we're kind of combining a couple of different things. His Operation Zero Tolerance is definitely about Bastion, and the Prime Sentinels, but doesn't have this component at all with Magneto flying off to the poles and shutting down the Earth's magnetic core, whatever. but that is something that happens very prominently in the Magneto Wars, which happens like a year and a half later in the comic. So I think that's very interesting and it makes me very curious where things are headed. But with Sinister there, clones are on the table. I kind of think we're headed for a Magneto versus Magneto face-off.
In the next two episodes.
Sure. Well, they've basically resolved the Prime Sentinel problem after one episode. So where is it headed?
Oh, yeah, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, Bastion is still around. Now, interestingly, I'm curious because we got a flash of Nimrod when we first got the exposure of Bastion last week. And I did do a little bit of research after we didn't do enough research last week. And I did remind myself that we find out in the comics that Bastion is actually Nimrod, who has gone through the Siege Perilous and been reconstituted as a person, and then like his Nimrodness, and Nimrod is like a sort of like a sentinel type thing from the future, is like designed to kill all mutants, you know, one of those,
a bit of an upgrade.
And the Siege Perilous is this like thing that like is not worth getting into, but basically you like you go into it and you get and then like you become a different thing, and except when you don't become a different thing because plot reasons, so
yeah, but you might become an Asian assassin
if you're Psylocke. If you're Storm, you become a child for no reason.
Exactly.
So, and sometimes you just wake up in Australia and that's what happens. So lots of different things can happen. But if you're Nimrod, you turn into Bastion, who basically doesn't necessarily realize that he's Nimrod until very late in the game. He just thinks that he's a boy who grows up to hate all mutants because they were mean to his mom or something, I think. And so, you know, and then eventually it's revealed that that's the case. So I'm curious if this change with the sort of techno-organic virus infecting his dad and making him I wonder if they're setting up the Nimrod connection or if they're replacing it with this origin story.
Oh yeah, because I mean, the origin story could just all be made up as well. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be real, right?
Yeah, because we get it from from Gene reading the psychic energy of his like childhood drawings or something. So I guess we're meant to believe it, but maybe there's like more to it, you know? Or maybe they were like, we can't touch the Siege Perilous, so this is our new solve for that problem.
But can we just jump back? Because I've just had a thought. If they have, if they do clone Magneto and suddenly Joseph shows up, that's two clone stories in 10 episodes.
Yeah, that sounds like enough. That sounds like exactly the amount of clones that I would expect from an X-Men story.
No, that would just be too much.
It lets us maintain a love triangle with Rogue and Magneto and
Rogue's
Joseph.
In a coma.
Well, she's gonna wake up, you know. Where's Carol Danvers? Call Carol Danvers over. She can just like suck up her life force again, wake up from her coma.
Yeah, okay. No, I don't know. Okay, sorry. I just had to bring that up. Let's go back to what we were talking about. What were we talking about?
We're talking about where things are headed with Bastion and all of this stuff. So I guess it's been kind of a freewheeling conversation in this corner of the podcast. But I guess like big picture, like where are things headed now? And are you satisfied with this cliffhanger that we're at?
Yes, I am. I hadn't thought about the fact that we've already resolved all the Sentinel problems. And so what are we going to do for the next 2 hours? So I will continue to ponder that this week.
They'll probably come back.
There'll be still some to, like, so maybe Magneto's deactivated all of those that have been activated, but the ones that haven't been activated is still, like, wandering around waiting to meet
a mutant in a comic book logic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, wait, I have to just say this because I forgot to mention this earlier. When all of them were getting activated, was your interpretation that Bastion was activating them at the same point that Beast happened to be looking for the scanner? Or was your interpretation that Beast inadvertently caused them all to activate while he was scanning for them?
Oh, mine was the former, but I mean, I wouldn't put it past Beast.
Because I thought it was the latter, and I thought it was maybe Beast through his just, you know, constant hubris accidentally did it all by himself. Because it was weird. But yeah, I guess it doesn't really matter who activated them, but it felt like it was a really weird coincidence that right when he happened to be looking for them is when all of them started to be activated. But I guess it could have been a coincidence.
I mean, yeah, like for a TV show, it's kind of like that would happen, right?
Yeah. Or maybe it was presented that way because he could only see them if they were activated. And so like he's doing scans and at first it seems like there's only a few. And then as they get activated, more and more pop up on the scan. Maybe that was what I was supposed to take away from it. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so that's basically the episode. We didn't really talk about the Bobby and Jubilee stuff.
No, and we didn't talk about,
Do you want to? That's my question. Because it's like, it feels like it's just a rehash of what happened last week.
Pretty much, yeah.
Except at the end, Bobby's mom is like, hey, with these cyborgs who are totally not here to hurt you.
So this is where there was a big plot hole for me. Like, they're all in this apartment that's like quite high up in this building. They've got this view of the world. Surely they can see all of these fights happening and all of these sentinels flying around. And then suddenly they're like, oh, well.
They're a bunch of self-indulgent rich people who are all absorbed in their own charitable goodness.
Yeah, but
they never even thought to look out the window.
Okay. So that felt very like, huh? What? Why would they just, why would this be the first time they saw a sentinel? Anyway. So yeah, no, I've got really nothing to say there other than Jubilee's
my thing on that,
to all life's problems is to go to the mall
and get a new outfit, which was a cool outfit. Was that a comic book reference, that outfit?
Yeah, she wears that outfit like in the like 2010s, maybe, like when she became a vampire. That was kind of what she was wearing around that time.
Okay, cool. I could see her as a vampire rocking that look. That makes sense to me. What I thought was a weird plot hole is the way Bastion explains the whole Prime Sentinel thing is like they go about their day. They don't know that they're able to be activated. And then suddenly they're around a mutant and then they activate to kill the mutant. And it's like, if that's how it works, then why did Bobby's butler not try to kill him last week?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Why did it have to wait until they were at the mall for like a while and then do it? Seems like he spent a lot of time with that butler over the last 24 hours. Why now did it act? Yeah. You know, like I was a little confused by that.
Yeah, good point. I thought about that as well. Yeah, all very weird.
Ultimately, I think all of that is just for Bobby to... Last episode, we kind of talked about how, like, maybe the story is, like, Bobby's going to come into his own and his powers, and then his mom's going to respect him unexpectedly. I don't think that's where we're headed with mom anymore.
No.
I think mom's just trash, and ultimately, it seems like this whole story has been a way to get Bobby to split from his family and to get Jubilee be held prisoner, because that's a key plot point in the comic book arc of Operation Zero Tolerance.
So
that's kind of all I have to say about that part of the episode, unfortunately. Yeah.
Bobby still hates himself. Jubilee's still kind of there supporting him, but not really doing much.
He learns how to fly, or he's been learning how to fly in the danger room, and it was a secret.
Yeah. But I mean, he is embracing his power, like you'd predicted, so there's that.
Yeah. But his mom totally took his knees out from under him. Yeah. I don't know. I feel like if my mom, who had previously said that she was supportive but ashamed of me, told me to go with the police that were trying to kill me, I think I would probably say no and leave. I don't think I would just be like, all right, well, my mom said, I guess I have no choice. I feel really bad. Like, yeah. I get that, like, he's having it a moment and it's, like, devastating that his mom would just say that. But I don't know. I feel like, what is Jubilee doing? Yeah, if he was going to do it, Jubilee's there and should be like, no, Bobby, go out the window. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, come on. You just showed me how you can fly. Let's go. Yeah.
Like, why else is she there if not to tell her not to listen to his mom in that moment?
Okay, so let's move on from that. I want to talk about my favorite thing about this episode.
Is it when Morph turned into the Juggernaut and then had Juggernaut's powers, even though he's not a mutant? Was that your favorite part?
No.
What is Morph's powers? Is Morph just literally the most powerful being in Marvel Universe?
If you watch the whole episode, you would see in the end credits, when they do the spinny 90s thing.
Yeah.
It does actually tell you what Morph's powers are, which is to morph into and mimic the powers of anyone
at all. Like, they like Morph could have the power of the Hulk.
I'm not sure what the wording is, but yes,
because Morph has the power of the Juggernaut, and we all know that the Juggernaut has from the
fairy
mystic
powers.
Gem. Mm-hmm. So it has nothing to do with mutants. So Morph could just, like, take Captain Marvel's powers, basically, and just, like...
Well, if Rogue can take them, why can't Mo? Why can't Mo?
So if that's the case, what is Morph doing in the background? Just, like, making jokes with Wolverine. Morph should be center stage.
Well, Morph just doesn't have, like, main character energy. Morph's just like, yeah, I'm chilling here. But maybe also, okay, so let's try and rationalize why Morph isn't more prominent. Maybe it's because Morph can only mimic their powers for a set period of time.
But, like, if Morph could mimic the powers of, like, Professor X, Morph could just turn into Professor X for a brief moment and knock everyone out, and that's it, fight over every time.
Maybe what was the
Morph
one?
Could morph into the Phoenix Force and just completely annihilate everyone with the power of the sun and then go take a nap.
So, you know, in The Runaways, have you read The Runaways?
I haven't. I have seen the first season of the Hulu original series, The Runaways, and that was enough for me. So, I've heard the comic is good.
Yeah, the comic is really good, but there's a character called Neko Minoru. I've said that wrong. Anyway, Neko. Yeah. Neko's a witch, right? Neko has this staff. Mm-hmm. Neko can make spells, but Neko can only do every spell once ever. So maybe that's the thing with Morph, right? Like, Morph can only turn into these other people once, and that's it. And that's why we've never seen Morph do this. Like, Morph was Illyana in one episode, and then it's never been Illyana again. So maybe...
Was Professor X just to be a dick? Did Morph blow his Professor X eligibility just to be a dick in the kitchen that one time?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't put it past Morph. Morph's a joker, right?
Yeah, anyway. Would be in character.
But I didn't tell you my favorite bit of the whole episode.
No,
my
you
favorite
didn't.
Bit
I'm
of
sorry.
The whole episode is that it took Professor X less time to get back to Earth and show up at the X-Mansion than it has for Storm to do the same.
Listen, it's not at all clear where Forge lives, okay? It's a desert.
I'm pretty
on
sure
the planet.
It's not
maybe it's
in the
Mars.
Middle of- Maybe, but I'm pretty sure it's not.
And we also fully have established that she can fly again. So there's really no excuse.
Yeah. She's just like, I'm going to just extend my holiday a bit. You can take care of Genosha, right?
Yeah. I did love that moment when Wolverine is like, man, we could really use Professor Xavier right about now. And then like, boom, crash land Professor Xavier with his bug helmet. Just like, I'm here. That service, man.
Yeah, really good.
And he's a telepath, so like, was he just like sitting around in loose orbit, just like waiting for someone to say his name?
So I would be. Down. I would be. Like, wait, now, let's go now. Yeah.
Like, he was about to be emperor of a galactic power, right? If you're gonna give all that up, the least you could do is set up an awesome entrance when you come home, right?
Yeah, but how anticlimactic. There's only like 3 X-Men there to greet you. You'd be like, oh, fuck. You're the boring
one. Well, it gives him a chance to do his whole, to me, my X-Men.
Yeah, thing, I guess. And so the only other things that we haven't talked about were all the cameos in this episode. Mm. Who did you spot?
I spotted Dr. Doom, mm-hmm. and Zemo, as we previously discussed. Mm-hmm. And Metal Man, I get credit for that. And also...
And Juggernaut, like you mentioned, even though that doesn't really count.
Juggernaut, yeah. And mm-hmm. the Stark Expo, I thought that was a fun little touch. Also, mm-hmm. of course, Spider-Man pops yes. up. That was exciting. We got to see Spider-Man. We got to see the Silver Samurai, which is very
yes.
exciting. And then who is... They cut to one other person, right? Who was the other person they cut
in,
to?
In that like little scene with Silver Samurai, yeah. there was Omega Red as well.
Omega Red, right, yeah. right.
You say Omega, I say Omega.
You say it like they do on Star Wars, The Bad Batch.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah, there's a character named Omega, and that's they always. But everyone there speaks with a New Zealand accent.
Oh, New Zealand. Okay.
Yeah.
And then at the beginning, when they were looking into the future, there was Polaris, who is Magneto's daughter. Oh, has she been in the cartoon? Anyway,
yes. I think there's a whole thing between her and Iceman. That's the X Factor episode, I think. Polaris is there.
So what's Iceman doing there?
It's like it's complicated.
Okay, it doesn't matter. And then no. Rachel Summers was also there in the flash forward scene.
Ooh, I didn't notice that.
Mm. So that was interesting. But on the Silver Samurai Omega Red thing, it'd be interesting to see if they show up.
Do you want them to?
I mean, they're not needed.
I'm not a fan of Omega Red. I'm not as a character.
Oh, why not? Because he's a terrible Russian stereotype.
Yeah, there's that. And also, and it's just like... The villainy is just very boring, you know? I like a Mr. Sinister villain who's scheming. I don't like it. Just like, I'm evil and I want to cause nuclear destruction.
Oh.
Like, you know, like it's not an interesting foil for Wolverine, in my opinion. Like, he's really strong, mm-hmm. right? He's got those like tendrils and stuff. And, mm-hmm. But, you know, and the death factor and all that. It's just not my vibe.
Yeah, I would agree with that, I guess. It's not like, wow, Omega Red, what a compelling character. But it's kind of nice when there's like a bit of variety and someone random just shows up. But I don't think it's necessary for the next 2 episodes because I think we've probably got enough to fuck with.
Yes, I agree. Silver Samurai would be fun, though. I feel like there's a lot on that bone that we can tap into.
Oh, so Russian stereotypes, no. Japanese stereotypes, yes.
Well, I'd like to think that they could broaden his characterization. Yeah. I mean, we just got out of Shogun, which was a huge hit for Hulu and Disney+. That was excellent. A lot of textured characters in that. Maybe we can bring some of that energy over to X-Men.
Oh, I watched the first episode of that and just wasn't into it.
Oh, you gotta stick with it because like the thing about the first episode is that it's all about like the British guy who's all like, I'm gonna curse and be angry at the Catholics.
Yeah, yeah.
The actual show is very little about him. In fact, like it's pointedly not about him for the whole second half of the show.
Oh, and that's, so why would they put him? Oh, okay.
I think it's kind of like they think that we need that as a point of view character, but it fades very quickly to the side of the show. And it's the better for it.
Oh, okay. Anyway, we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about X-Men. What are you looking forward to most in the next 2 episodes?
I want to know what Mr. Sinister is scheming. Mm-hmm. I think that Bastion has been a little bit more interesting than I thought he would be. Theo James, who's an actor that I really like from White Lotus, and he's on that The Gentleman Netflix show right now that's really popular. He voices him in this, and I think that he's a little bit more interesting than I expected, but ultimately still not my kind of villain. I want to go deep into whatever Sinister is scheming. And so that's the thing I'm most looking forward to finding out, especially if I turn out to be correct and we're headed for a Magneto versus Magneto face off. How about you?
I think I'm most looking forward to the big movie ending where everything feels kind of resolved at the end and all of the gang is back together. That's probably the big thing. And also, I still think the next season is Avengers versus X-Men. I think the evidence in this episode is Spider-Man and that Stark whatever poster thing in Bastion's room. I think it's leading us up to. So I kind of want to be vindicated. Because I'm a petty bitch.
you have all your chips on Avengers versus X-Men. I have all my chips on Age of Apocalypse being what's going to get teased. I've never felt better about that with all of this Cable stuff and Sinister schemes and all of that. So I'm feeling good.
Ooh, and it will be neither of those.
No, I'm sure it'll be. I'll be like, oh no, it's young Jean and Scott coming from the past. Like, what? Not that one.
Oh no. We're going to Alaska again. Okay.
I was reading what happened in Operation Zero Tolerance, and it does end with Jean and Scott going to Alaska for a while. It's like, of course it does.
Well, is that to look forward to?
So, yeah. Listen, if I fell out of the sky almost to my death in Alaska, I would always return to it whenever I was feeling sad. So I get it. Makes sense.
Yeah.
speaking of places that people like to go, one place that you could go to hear more about Kay is his podcast, Lost Spaces. Kay, tell the folks what's going on over there.
Well, it is a podcast wherein every week I speak to a different person about a lost queer space and what it meant to them, what they got up to there, and how it helped shape the person that they've become. And it's basically just an excuse for me to ask lots of really intrusive questions, and then they're too polite to tell me to fuck off. So it's kind of, yeah, a fun little romp through people's memories. And it is a podcast. Did you already say that it was a podcast? I'm not sure. I'm just talking
about
it.
I believe so. But
this much. Yes.
Yeah, we should keep saying that it's a podcast just so people know that it's a podcast.
If you've never heard of a podcast, then I'm not really sure what you're doing listening to this, but it's a thing that you listen to. And if you listen to that and you like that, then you should also follow me on Instagram or TikTok or Facebook, where I am Lost Spaces Pod.
And Kay, I know it was a while ago, but I believe you do have at least one X-Men connection on that podcast that maybe our X-friendly listeners would want to hear about.
What a good tie-in. Cena Grace, yes, who wrote and illustrated the Iceman series from a few years back.
Yes. And that was a really fun episode. It was wild. About a year ago that came out?
Yeah, I'd say a year, yes, probably.
Comb back into the archives or just Google their name and Lost Spaces. We'll probably pop it up. As for me, you can follow me on Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow me on Blue Sky at Alex Marcus. You can go to thepotbreak.com, click on the podcast tab, see all the podcasts that we got going for you. And as I've said, The Pot Break is the new podcast feed. We combined Pot Break TV and Pot Break Today, put all of your favorite shows from both feeds into one. If you subscribed to Pot Break TV, you don't have anything to do. We just changed the name. If you subscribed to Pot Break Today, and not Pot Break TV, but you are listening to this maybe on the website, maybe somewhere else, definitely subscribe to The Pot Break. Find that on every place you get podcasts, including Spotify and Apple podcasts. We got a lot of fun stuff. Next week, I got Bill versus the MCU, a new episode. We're going to be recording that this weekend. I still have not watched any of the Wolverine movies, but by the time you hear that episode, I will have. And because we're doing a full episode on the Wolverine trilogy, which, as I like to say, is three movies. And the only thing they have in common is that they all star Wolverine. So it's a Wolverine, X-Men Origins Wolverine, The Wolverine, and of course, Logan. So if you want to hear me and my co-host with Bladkin talk about that, you can check that out. Kay, this is around the time when I usually let you ask me a question about the Fox universe.
And this week I will ask, why do you think no human being can ever accurately portray Storm?
Ooh, that's good. I think because they have never let a person of color write any of those scripts or direct any of the movies.
I think it's a fault in the script.
Yeah, absolutely. Because listen, I think that I have now watched all of the movies that Storm was in very recently. Mm-hmm. What you see, especially in the Halle Berry portrayal, is someone who is really fighting to make that character be more central and to have an actual arc and have a story that matters, and constantly being pushed into the sidelines. And no one who reads the X-Men comic books would ever want to treat Storm that way because she's such a compelling character. Mm. So the only answer that I can come up with is these are people who have not spent time with this character and who, for reasons conscious or not, are, you know, predisposed to pushing her for the characters that they think are more important or more popular, like Scott and Jean and Wolverine. So I think that's what the problem is. And I think that that problem will likely be solved in the next iteration. Cause I think that Kevin Feige, despite not being a person of color, is very well adept with the comics, knows what fans want out of a story, and knows that Storm is one of the most compelling characters in the entire X lineup. And I just don't see him repeating the same mistakes of the past.
Okay. We'll see. We'll see.
We will see. In addition to that podcast, which comes out next Tuesday on The Pop Break, you can listen to my podcast called TV Break. And that episode just came out a couple of days ago. And we talked all about the Neil Gaiman Dead Boy Detectives adaptation for Netflix. And that is a show that my co-hosts, Josh Cernarchi and Bill Bodkin, really liked. And I really didn't. So if you're used to hearing me play Positive Penny on this podcast, check out TV Break, where I completely go on a long rant about why I thought that show was hot garbage. And my co-hosts, who really enjoyed it and said that I was wrong. So you'll have to see for yourself.
Oh, it's good when there's a bit of tension.
But so until then, okay, next week, part 2, big grand finale.